I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival. My name is Scintilla Chingayipe. I'm a journalist and filmmaker, and I'll be moderating this session. Before we begin, I would like to respectfully acknowledge that we are meeting on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'd like to pay my respects to their elders, past, present and future, and also acknowledge any elders from other communities that might be with us this afternoon. In a year in which much of the news and public attention has been swallowed up by pandemic updates, the focus on climate change has wavered. School children and youth activists have become some of the strongest voices advocating for climate action, urging policymakers to act now to save their future. And some of those young activists are joining us this afternoon, and I'll begin introducing them. I'll begin first with Jean Hinchliffe, who is furthest from me, and she is a 17-year-old climate justice activist and an organiser within School Strike for Climate. Jean began her activism at age 13 when she volunteered with the Yes campaign for marriage equality. Since then, she has also worked with organisations such as Get Up and Stop Adani. Jean's first book, Lead the Way, How to Change the World from a Teen Activist and School Striker, was published by Pantera Press last month. And sitting next to Jean is Varsha Yajban, and Varsha is an 18-year-old university student and climate advocate. She has been an organiser for School Strike for Climate and was a 2020 New South Wales Schools Coordinator for the AYCC. She's currently a paralegal at Equity Generation Lawyers, which conducts climate change litigation. Seeing the inadequacy of climate change being taken sparked her passion to engage in an intersectional movement that is not only about fighting for climate action, but climate justice. And last but not least, there's Daisy Jeffrey, who is a high school student and organiser in the
school...
No longer.
Uni student.
And uni, congratulations.
You might be reading an old blurb. On bio.
Well, I'll keep going and you can correct me.
Yes, for sure.
But you are, you were one of the organisers of the school climate strikes, which was one of the largest protests in Australian history, galvanising over 300,000 people to demand climate action. Daisy is also a fierce champion for gender equality and she's the author of On Hope. So can you please join me in welcoming our panellists? So I guess I'll start there. So you're not in high school anymore. You're at uni. Can I ask what you're studying?
I'm studying politics, philosophy and economics, which I think is not an entirely unpredictable route. I'm studying at ANU. So, yeah, I'm really enjoying it.
Well, congratulations. I mean, like I said, you're incredibly impressive. What you've been able to accomplish at such young ages just blows me away. And I'm curious, how did you get into activism? I might start with you, Jean.
Yeah, so I think that I've always been a very political person and deeply cared about lots of different matters of social justice. But the first thing that properly got me into activism was getting involved in the Yes campaign for marriage equality. And I was 13 years old and I'd heard a bit about it and I knew I wanted to get involved somehow, but I didn't really know what that would be. And then I saw that you could phone bank with them. So I called my mum and I was like, hey, can I go into the city at 7 o'clock tomorrow and sit in a room with a bunch of adults I don't know and call people and tell them to vote yes? And surprisingly, she said yes. So after getting involved in that, I just loved it. It was this incredible feeling of being able to make a tangible change. Because I think being a young person, you feel so stuck in the sense that you can't vote and no one will listen to you and it feels like you really can't make a very real and tangible difference. So it felt suddenly like I could almost measure the change I was making. So I sort of stayed involved since and I got involved in my local Get Up group as well as Stop Adani. And then after a bit of involvement in that, I started the Sydney group for School Strike for Climate after a friend of mine sort of sent me the link to this website that was 2 or 3 days old and they'd been organising an event in Melbourne. And I just jumped at it. I knew that it felt like such an exciting and very, again, it was very tangible and it felt like it was making a very real and noticeable difference. And ever since then, I've been involved in School Strike for Climate and just super deeply involved within activism.
Mm. What about for you, Varsha?
For me, I was a little bit older than Jane. I was 16, I was in year 11. And my school sent her on this link to join the Australian Youth Climate Coalition, and they had this student climate leadership program. And I was like, okay, this sounds interesting. I honestly didn't really know too much about climate change. I think at school, you're just given an exam, and it's like, here, this is what the ozone layer is. It's depleting, and that's it. So to be mentored by a bunch of high school, first-year university students and being taught that climate change is so much closer to home, that it's not just climate change, but it's climate justice, and that people on the front lines of communities are being affected so heavily. And the fact that this wasn't on the news, so we weren't talking about this more, just made me really angry and frustrated. So I continued the program, finished it, and then School Strike for Climate started, thanks to Jane, and joined that. And from there on, just like continued organizing. And I guess that's where it's led to now.
Wow. Daisy?
Like Jane, I've always been pretty political. And I think climate change had been always something that was on the back of my mind. I remember watching like Behind the News in year five or something, and they'd done, you know, a 10-minute segment on it. And it was, you know, it was something that you were sort of aware of as a kid, but it wasn't ever at the forefront of your mind. It just didn't feel really like it was a tangible threat. And I think it would have been in 2016, 2017, that sort of awareness, at least how we were taught and what was being published, on the science, began to feel like a more tangible threat. But as a young person, someone who was in high school, I really didn't feel like there was anything I could do about it. And then when the Sydney component of the school strike started, actually I was inspired by Jane. I went along to the first protest. I wasn't part of the organisational process. And I saw Jane speak, and I saw her on the news, and here was this young woman who was, you know, she was at a public selective high school like me, and she was doing this incredible work and just being so brave, and, you know, throwing off this criticism that, you know, certain elements of the media were throwing at her. And I thought, I really wanted to get involved and I wanted to help out, and it has been a very tumultuous experience, but also just absolutely incredible. But I think the more aware you are, the more work you do on it, the more you are aware of just how much of a threat this is to everyone, and particularly those on the front lines of this crisis.
Mm. Yeah. So, Jane, you write in your book, which is really wonderful in terms of as serving as a guide into activism, basically. But so how do you go from being passionate about these issues, caring about them, to then organising national protests? How does that happen?
Yeah, I think that one thing about it is that if someone is new to activism and they're wanting to get involved and make a difference, you see these big things like the climate strikes and these massive national protest movements, and it feels like that's the most important space to be involved with because it is so big and it gets all this attention. But I really think for anyone who is at a point when they're first getting involved, the most effective change that is made is grassroots level community-based organizing. And I think a lot of that for someone is just sort of having the confidence and the belief in themselves to realize that their voice matters and has influence, and they're able to make that real tangible change. And I think that a big part of it is that when people, particularly when they're young, they're told their entire lives that their voice doesn't really matter, and that, you know, wait until you can vote, or like there's no point as to what you're doing and what you're saying. So then people think of themselves as unqualified and as though they're not able to make a difference. So they sort of stop themselves. So I think that it's really a matter of looking at it and seeing how no one else really knows what they're doing. Everyone is getting involved in this new, ever-changing space and just trying to do the best they can to make that change. And that you are able to be part of that and learn continuously as part of that as well. But getting involved, sort of looking at what exists in your community and what exists already around you, and seeing where the gaps are and seeing where you can make the most effective difference.
And then honestly, it's just a process of getting involved, which sounds so simple, but it is a scary and quite a daunting process. But yeah, I think that if we look at activism as this sort of glamorous, really intense, media-saturated space, it becomes inaccessible and it becomes not real and not what it actually is. But if we look at it as community level, often quite small acts, often things that go unnoticed when people get involved in that, that's where we're seeing the really, again, I'm saying it a lot, tangible and very real change. Mm.
Varsha, I mean, one of the things that's really wonderful about the protests and the movements and what you're all doing is that I feel that it was quite successful in bringing greater awareness to this issue of climate change in this country. I think people are more aware of it and are talking about it because of a lot of the activism that you're all doing. I wonder, why do you think it was that successful in cutting through to people where before perhaps people in policy had failed to communicate sort of complex issues?
I think, like Jean mentioned, a lot of it is grassroots change. And I feel like these protests and these strikes have kind of addressed the fundamental issue, and that's the people being affected by climate change aren't always inner city people. It's people on the front lines. And by having a bunch of youth, a bunch of teenagers come together and organize, I feel like we're thinking beyond the box of just economics and finance and just leaving it at that. But it's really about people and compassion. And I think the way we see it is a little bit different. And I think that's where public policy fails, that it's not actually considering the people who are experiencing climate change because they're in their own echo chambers. But when you have people from such diverse experiences, diverse backgrounds coming together, it really does help create something that's bigger than just thinking about one or two categories, which I think our government continues to do. And I think that's why we've seen such inadequate climate action.
Mm. Daisy, just following on from what Varsha's talking about and the impacts of climate change being felt very differently across communities. You write in your books that you describe yourself as a city kid, and that the impacts of climate change for you are very different to you. Mm-hmm. You talk about, you know, when it comes to Indigenous Australians, the impact of climate change is felt very differently in those communities and people that live in regional towns. And I wondered if you could just expand on how climate change impacts people quite differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a range of different experiences, but we know, like, the most obvious difference is that, you know, you have a lot of these regional towns are by the bush or they're more vulnerable to drought. Cities often have a lot more resources. It's a whole sort of, there are a spectrum of ways in which you can be affected by climate change, but perhaps the most obvious example is the bushfire crisis at the end of 2019 to the beginning of 2020, which, you know, that was the point. I think everyone became very aware of the problem, particularly in the cities where we hadn't really been firsthand experiencing the ramifications, but all of a sudden we were breathing in smoke and the sky was sort of yellow all day. And sometimes you'd walk outside the house and there'd actually be ash falling or this weird smell. I think that was when, and because the fire was getting, I think, you know, closer to the outskirts of the city, and that was people, like this was in Sydney, and people were a lot more aware, I think, within cities, whereas I think in regional and rural Australia, there's suddenly been an awareness that there's greater vulnerability to the repercussions of climate change, but the public discourse, I think, when it comes to climate change is a lot more complex, particularly due to the way that it's been used as a political football by both sides of politics. And there's the way in which politics frames it, but there's this sort of revolving door of money and lobbying. For instance, like 2 years ago, we had the Australian Minerals Council admit to a Senate committee that political donations do give lobbyists more access to politicians, which is something we all knew, but it's sort of this public admission that money has a lot of sway within politics, and that's certainly affecting the discourse that we have, and it's really dangerous for regional and rural communities to continue to have this sort of, you know, I don't know how to describe it, but like it's like we've hit a wall and most of the world is moving forward, but Australia is still sort of back here. And I think the school strike protests were incredibly effective in terms of getting people to talk about it, getting people engaged. With the last big school strike in September 2019, you know, we saw over 300,000 Australians take to the streets of all ages. I think we had a 97-year-old World War II veteran there, you know, and then down to like basically newborns. And so it was just to have that sort of wealth of experience that so many different people just coming together to demand collective action. And then when the bushfire crisis hit, that was when you had many people, the tens of thousands of people, take to the streets at very short notice to demand change because the threat was all of a sudden on everybody's doorstep. Mm. And, you know, the pandemic has meant that it's no longer sort of right in front of everyone. For a lot of people, it's really in their periphery. We also, this very severe drought that we had a lot of rainfall at the very end of last year and the beginning of this year. And so climate change for a large portion of the population is nowhere near the same concern that it was, but it's still a really big threat. It's like if you put a frog in boiling water, it's going to jump out. And that's what we've done with this pandemic. It's, you know, we've absolutely leapt out of the boiling water. But if you stick a frog in water and then you bring it to the boil, it will die. And that's what Australia is doing on climate. We owe it to ourselves. We also owe it to Pacific nations who we've really been neglecting when it comes to climate. And that's a hugely concerning thing. And what we need to see is politicians really step up and take action to unblock political discourse. And instead of making it this whole massive debate of what's this and what's this and making it very partisan, make it a really bipartisan thing of both sides working together towards a collective solution, which is just not what we're seeing at the moment because there's so much work being done to divide everyone.
Mm.
Yeah, anyway.
There's a lot there and I want to give us some room to unpack it. It made me think of something Boris Johnson said last week about bunny huggers. I don't know if you heard him describing, it was just really wrong. But anyway, this idea of failure of policy and people in leadership. Jean, if we can pick up on it. So clearly, you know, people within communities are galvanised. People want to see action on climate change. People want to see our government make real commitments. Why do you think there is this disconnect between what the general population seems to want and the urgency by which we want it, and the failure for politicians to actually listen?
Yeah, I think that there is a lot that has gone into it. I mean, one particularly massive thing which Daisy touched on is lobbying, and you see groups like the Minerals Council, which has actually been identified as one of the greatest threats to sort of climate change worldwide in the sense that they have so much political influence. But I think one of the biggest issues we have and one of the biggest incongruences is that climate change has turned into a very partisan issue, and the idea of climate action has been deemed this sort of lefty concern when it ultimately isn't whatsoever. It just makes economic sense. So I think that when it's framed as this partisan thing where it immediately has to be associated with all these other values, and there's a lot that goes with it, and it also, even further than that, is associated as the idea of people who are demanding climate action as, you know, inner city lefties who don't really know what it's like. And it's all about this division. And once you have that division, and when you have it associated with all these other things, even though you have groups of people who believe that the climate crisis is real and pressing, and believe that ultimately we do need action, it's difficult for them to support it when it feels like there's all these other values and everything else that goes with it. So I think that school strike, one thing which has been effective about us as a movement, is trying to cut through that political discourse. Because as soon as it's seen as this left versus right issue, we don't get anywhere. Mm. Because it shouldn't be a political issue. It shouldn't be framed as which politicians believe in it, which politicians are demanding action or not. It should be a debate around how exactly we create this action in the most effective way possible. Because we don't have political debates over whether the sky is blue. You know, it's not it's been co-opted in this way, when if we saw it for what it was, as a matter of science and as a crisis we were faced with today, I think that we'd be able to sort of be much more effective in the way that we tackle it. Mm. I think that that political discourse has just really held us back. And if we were to acknowledge it as a crisis for what it is, and have leaders see it in the same way that we saw the pandemic, you know, if that had turned into a left versus right thing like you saw in the US, you know, we'd be in crisis still with it. Yeah, but acknowledge it for what it is and just take action accordingly. Because as soon as you have all this fluff and discourse around it, nothing really happens.
Yeah. Varsha, I want to pick up on something that Daisy talked about and this idea around our responsibility within our region, within the Pacific. I think it was last week at the summit that Joe Biden convened and all these commitments were being made and we didn't really make that many great commitments. But New Zealand did something what was quite remarkable because they also, apart from the targets that they set, they sort of made a financial commitment to assist communities within Pacific Island nations that are already being impacted by climate change, that nothing will actually be able to reverse that that devastation. And so I wonder, what is our responsibility within our region when it comes to thinking about communities that are being significantly impacted already by climate change?
I think one of the problems is that climate change, or like the entire climate movement, I guess in some regards, is quite whitewashed. At least during the pandemic last year, I think we all had a lot of time for reflection, and I spent a lot of mine doing that. And as a woman of color, I kind of came to realize that I was in this amazing space, and while I am so grateful for it, it sometimes does feel like, as humans, we're already put in these boxes, but as a woman of color, you've got more boxes to unpack, to come out of, and it's really, really hard. And I think the reason that we don't understand climate change to be that big of an issue, or well, our government doesn't, at least, is because we only look at the media narratives, of, and a lot of that is just inner city kids striking for climate action. And that's not true at all, because I know that when we were organizing for School Strike for Climate, we definitely did reach out to other communities, but that's not portrayed front and center in the media. So when it comes to our commitments as a country, I don't think people are actually thinking about it. I think a lot of the times it's, oh, the bushfires were really terrible, and then all of a sudden we had a pandemic, and then we have floods, and you have somebody like Angus Taylor tweeting, I thought climate change was about droughts. And the message is then like turned around, and it's kind of about remobilizing all those people in the first place. And so figuring out what our obligations are so difficult, but I think it's quite obvious because climate change, climate justice is a human rights issue. So it really is about looking after our Pacific Islanders. I think Jacinda Ardern's done such an amazing job in leading New Zealand. And I think Australia should be at the forefront of that. We're the largest exporter of coal. We're one of the largest, and we still don't seem to be doing much about it. So I really think that it's important that the whole narrative around climate change changes, and that hasn't been happening. And with the pandemic, it definitely got swept under the rug. But School Strike has their massive strike coming up on May 21st, obviously COVID safe, but I think it's those things that are slowly starting to build the momentum back up. We're starting to see it on the news more. The fact that Scott Morrison was on mute half the time at the climate summit was a bit of a joke.
I think Biden left before he even spoke as well.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not like he had anything to say, so might as well have been on mute. But
can I just ask, what do you think when you hear our prime minister talking and not really making any real commitments?
Oh my gosh.
How does that make you feel?
It's embarrassing. It's so embarrassing. And it's frustrating because you just hear these people telling you that, you know, you should be at school. You're not doing enough. You're putting your education at stake. And it's like, well, I'm not going to have anything to practice or study if there's no future. If I'm underwater, there's literally not going to be anything. And I don't understand why we're putting all these like random ideas in people's minds that, you know, climate change isn't an issue, and it clearly is. So I think it's that dialogue and it's that narrative that organizations like School Strike have constantly tried to change, and I think it has worked, but there obviously needs to be more done, and a lot of that does come from our government.
Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention also, because I think on top of the whole climate crisis thing and humanitarian issues, if you're looking at it purely in terms of economics, we look really stupid. Yes. Like, it's pure idiocy. It is, like, beyond the whole end of the world bit, what we're doing currently makes no financial sense. You know, like, we have so much potential to be investing in the renewables industry at the moment, not just to provide full renewable energy for Australia, but to be exporting that energy. We know that fossil fuels are, you know, they're slowly, definitely not quickly enough, but they're on decline and they're becoming irrelevant and they're not the future. And if we take steps now to invest in what we know that where the future will be, you know, we could have, we have so much, not just economic potential, but the amount of jobs we could provide. It would just be this new thriving sector of the economy that we are entirely neglecting for the most stupid reasons, really. Like, it makes no sense, anything that we're doing on any level. It's just so deeply illogical that, yeah, we look like idiots.
I want to add on to that. On a slightly optimistic note, you know, I think the Biden's climate summit, and I certainly don't, they're not as ambitious on climate as they could be, but, and it's not hard to be significantly better than his predecessor, but, you know, they are. And John Kerry, who is Biden's basically, you know, head on climate, is certainly a very significant improvement. He's not a big fan of Scott Morrison, and I think the threat of political embarrassment saw Scott Morrison sort of scrambling to pull together some last-minute targets, really, for the summit. He failed pretty abysmally. And I think that hopefully pressure, you know, at least will start to build up from that. And the other thing is that, you know, it makes much more economic sense to be investing in renewables, as Jane said. You know, we spend billions each year subsidising the fossil fuel industry. And there's also this narrative that's been pushed that the climate movement and workers are on opposing sides, and that's not true at all. There's also this assumption that I think it's made that workers and corporations, like workers in the fossil fuel industry and corporations, are somehow at one with each other, which is, you know, the furthest from the truth it could be. I was filming this documentary at the end of last year, and I met this taxi driver called Greg. And Greg had been working up in coking coal in Queensland, which is very different from thermal coal, which is what we use to create electricity. Coking coal is more like stainless steel. And so we came from very different sides of the sort of this divide or this narrative that has been perpetuated. And so ended up having, over a few days, having these really incredible discussions where I got to hear a lot about his life and, you know, how he'd ended up in that industry and why he'd left and whatnot. And workers, he was the union delegate. And workers and corporations are not working together. And this hurtful, what we see is particularly this government and people like Angus Taylor and Matt Canavan, who I don't know, he fascinates me. But you know, they say, oh yeah, we're here for jobs, and you know, basically this idea that coal is forever. And the other thing is that the federal government has moved they're shifting towards gas now because they really are starting to realise that coal is very it's a declining sort of industry. But this idea that coal is going to be around forever and that they somehow stand for jobs, and Joel Fitzgibbon saying that he stands for jobs, and it's like they don't, because they're standing for this delusional narrative that those jobs are going to be around there forever, when even these massive, fossil fuel corporations are realising that it's no longer a sensible financial investment. And so what we need to see from both sides of politics is a transition policy to provide a pathway for workers out of this industry. And it's not easy because you've got these entire towns, these communities, which have been built up around the fossil fuel industry. That's what they're entirely economically dependent on. Their community identity sits within that. And so what do you do when those industries are no longer around? And that's something we knew about 30 years ago when the science came out. Like we really, I think it was around more the sort of Gillard era that we started to see this real divide open up. And it had already happened in the US, but it particularly, you know, around 2010 became very much a left versus right issue when it never should have been. And there'd been this bipartisan consensus to stick to the science before. And so we have had more than 30 years now to put together a just transition policy for these workers. And these workers, these communities have become a political like football. And so what happens when these industries dry up? You know, will they be left in the cold? And so this narrative that, you know, this government is fighting for jobs and that they're fighting for these communities is completely untrue. It very much feels like they're just furthering their own self-interests, you know, fueled by ideology, fueled by money. And so these, you know, we really need to see a bipartisan effort in politics, particularly for these communities who are aware that they are not being taken care of. And there's this real opportunity for really any political party. I think the Greens were the only ones who brought a just transition policy to the last election. But for a bipartisan effort to see who can put together the most ambitious transition policy for these workers. And at the moment, neither side of politics is showing promise. And so that's a little, that's concerning, but you know, just back on that more optimistic note, the new administration in the US provides a small smidgen of hope that we're going to be headed in the right direction. Mm. But yeah.
I mean, I'm listening to all three of you talk, not just passionately, but, you know, clearly about an issue that is so important to so many of us. And it seems to me that, you know, you are so aware of what we need to be doing in terms of, as a country, the sorts of commitments we need to be making. And I wonder what, and it feels like, you know, we're getting in the way of you guys essentially working at a solution. And so my question is, how can those of us that are, whether it's your elders, the teachers, your wider community, how, what can we do? Because we clearly need to step aside because you know what you know what to do. But how can we support what you're doing to sort of see the sorts of changes that you're lobbying for?
I think one thing actually about that is that the notion that older people should be stepping aside, I actually disagree with. Because I think now's the time to be stepping up. Because young people, like these ideas, you know, then ultimately not out. We didn't discover the climate crisis. We haven't designed this policy. It's been around for a while. You know, we've been listening to experts and we're just relaying that information ultimately. And I think that I really appreciate when older people sort of relay similar messages and sort of mention how, you know, we're the future and we have so much potential to change politics and whatnot. But if we wait for the time that we're in power and the point at which we have very strong political influence, it'll be far too late. And I think the most useful thing any adult can do is step up. And I think listen to us and listen to the experts and, you know, vote accordingly, get involved in community organizing, write letters to your MP, call them also. Just get involved in as many ways as you can. And sort of, you can float around spaces, figure out where best you make the most effective difference. But yeah, young people shouldn't have to have the burden of making the change regarding this.
We're certainly not going to make headway without an intergenerational push.
Yeah. Did you want to add to that?
Sure. I also think it's things like super funds that matter because at the end of the day, it seems like a lot of our corporations are actually taking a step forward to climate justice instead of our government. So it's this really like backward cycle. And to be quite honest, like I got my first super fund maybe like last year. So until then, I couldn't even vote in elections. I still haven't voted in my first election. How much power do I really have? Like I can go out on the streets and scream and I can call my MP and tell them to do things, but at the end of the day, the adults do have a lot of the power. So change your super fund to one that's more sustainable. It's really small things like that. You know, call up your super fund and say, why are you investing X amount in all these gas and coal companies? I know that can seem like that's not going to make a change. But at the end of the day, if you have like 15,000 people calling up their super fund, that does do something. So I think it's really that intergenerational divide of older people don't understand the climate crisis. That's not true. I've seen so many amazing protesters, so many amazing activists who've been campaigning for climate justice since the 70s and before that. So it really isn't just up to us, and all of you have so much power as well. So, yeah.
Did you want to add to that, Daisy?
I think you guys said it all. It's just, you know, making those personal differences turn into collective action. And, you know, definitely that intergenerational effort is so important. So, yeah, I mean, it will be crucial to making any headway with this. So, yeah, I mean, we were at our most powerful when we had our general climate strike. The last massive climate strike we had, we invited people of all ages, and that was our biggest, it was our strongest, and it was an incredibly powerful moment. And I think it's time that we continue to push for that same momentum. But, yeah, that's it.
Sounds like great advice. Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you for a really wonderful panel. It's one of the best I've been to, and I've been here for 3 days. I wanted to ask this. In order to change things in this country, we need to convince people in electorates in North Queensland and in Western Australia to change their minds. And I'd really like you to comment on how that might be done, because it's clearly not done by driving up there from Tasmania and telling them they're wrong.
Yeah, well, on that, I actually did talk to Bob Brown when I was writing my book, and he adamantly defended that trip. And look, I think it was done with really good intentions, but I can imagine if I was in one of those communities, my identity was with the coal industry, and if people came up from way down south with their signs saying stop Adani, came into my community, particularly when Adani had actually planted roots. So they're in that community, they'd invested, you know, what these corporations do is they sort of infiltrate these communities. They invest in things like, you know, a school playground or a little football field over here or whatnot. And it's just, it just gets to be a really complicated situation. And I think however much that group that went up north wanted to connect with workers, the way they did it came across as a threat. And I think the only way you can see change in those communities is by having grassroots work start within those communities. And I think, you know, I've seen a couple of groups try to do that, and it's really difficult. But starting, you know, having those conversations with workers, and actually, instead of having this sort of binary, you say this and I say that and we just can never work together, we need to sort of build a bridge over this divide. And that's not going to happen with people yelling at each other, unfortunately. We don't have much time. But that work really needs to start within these communities. And that concern is there within those communities. There's just a lot of effort being done to shut it down. But once we, you know, start to invest in community power, that's when I think you'll start to see tangible change. But yeah, I'm sorry, that wasn't a very clear answer.
I think also on that, it's like you were saying earlier, the idea of just transition and, yeah, building bridges and having genuine conversations and saying, like, we don't want you guys to be left behind. Like, we don't, in this transition, we want a just and fair society for all. And that includes people who were employed in the fossil fuel industry. And centering their voices and having these conversations and seeing how, because we need to acknowledge the fact that, you know, these jobs aren't going to be here forever. The world is changing and to a point where fossil fuels are becoming irrelevant. So we need to take preemptive steps, talking with communities and seeing how we can best help them and create strategies to ensure that they are ultimately better off with this transition. And part of that is not just going in and saying that you're wrong or that you're fueling this crisis and this is all your fault, because it's also acknowledging that workers who are just trying to provide for their families and, you know, they're not the reason that this crisis exists. You know, it's not their fault that this is happening. It's just they've kind of landed in the middle of it, you know. We just have to have these conversations and not come into it with these judgments already had, I think. Mm.
Do you have another question?
In the late 1970s, I read a magazine called The New Scientist, which was the first time I heard that some scientists were thinking that there was a possibility that human behaviour may be impacting on the climate. And I just thought, oh, my God. And if you'd asked me then, I would have said what the future would be. I would have said that this is really serious and the world would come together and would take action. And I never in my wildest dreams ever expected what has unfolded on the ensuing decades. It's just unbelievably awful as far as I'm concerned. But my question is, in terms of you've been talking about, you know, action impacting on politicians and that and changing perspectives, but how do as a group or how do we all deal with this level of disinformation that is really impacting because it makes one feel that one's voice is very small?
I think that the only way that misinformation can be combated is by people holding the media to account, which is a very difficult thing to do. But we've seen suddenly this year, in particular, Kevin Rudd and Malcolm Turnbull calling for a media diversity inquiry. And I think that's going ahead now in the Senate. So that's something that is combating that misinformation. And I feel like looking to diversify our media even further is a good thing. But, you know, also since 2011, our media, because unfortunately print media is an ever-shrinking pool, we're seeing the media sort of diversify a bit more, but it's a really sort of really difficult area just to do with, like, it's sort of new waters for everyone. And yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how that goes. And then you also have the internet, because anyone could say anything on the internet. So if we're looking for reliable sources of information, that comes with continuing to hold media to account, really looking at how diverse our media concentration here is in Australia, and it's not very. So it'll be interesting to see what the next few months bring, and also I think the public play a huge role in holding media to account because we're the ones who consume it. So changing your subscription or, you know, just writing letters, not necessarily to the opinion page, but, you know, just I think that's really all we can do.
Asha, if I can follow up on that, just picking up on that question, this idea of social media and misinformation, it is a bit of a challenge, particularly when we're talking about democracy. We know that a lot of political campaigns have been undermined because of misinformation, and clearly a lot of the good work that not just what you guys are doing, but other people in this space that are lobbying for change is being undermined by misinformation on social media. And just speaking explicitly to that, I mean, how do you tackle that? The fact that if someone can tweet something or put something on Facebook that undoes all of this advocacy that you're doing?
I think the best way to see it is that it isn't undoing it. I always look at criticism or whatever it may be as, like, people are noticing it. Like, if they're bothered to actually put a negative comment out there, about, like, what any of us are doing, clearly it's making some sort of impact. And I know you can't always see it like that, but I think the main thing is media narratives are, they shift and then they change and then they stop suddenly, and it's like that wall that you hit. And I think what's really key and what we've seen is that the more you do to combat it, or the more you try and, you know, comment back and reply, it just doesn't work. And sometimes there's just too many comments to reply to, and you just leave it. And I think you just need to carry on with what you're doing, because the more you organize, the more people you mobilize, the greater the impact is going to be. I know that the September 2019 strike, I saw people there that I never thought would ever show up to a protest. And, you know, they're usually more pro-coal, but they were there at the strike. They made up the 80,000 people in Sydney. And I think that does show that even though you've got all that hate, that's just one side to the story. And I think you can try and convince everyone that climate change is real, that it's something that we need to tackle. But there are just certain people that instead of wasting your time trying to convince them or trying to, you know, attack their ideas, that it's just better to move on and continue with what you're doing. And I think media sort of has changed a little bit. Like a couple weeks ago, there was an amazing Four Corners report on the gas industry, and it was quite superficial. It didn't really dive into everything, but it exposed that the government does get a lot of money from these corporations, and that's something that a lot of people don't know, or, you know, it's kind of this like conspiracy theory going around. And I think those sorts of avenues in media really do clear it up. I think it's just a diversity.
Just quickly on political donations, I found this out the other day. I think it's half of all political donations made to political parties are made by 5% of the donors. And there are, you know, a couple of people who are really significant on that list, not least of which is Clive Palmer, who actually spent over 80 million Australian dollars on the last federal election. But that's something to really keep an eye on, is that we need tougher regulations on our political donations, because at the moment I think there's a ban on donations over $1,000 from international groups. And then there's the rule that you have to disclose donations over $13,800 from, you know, if you're donating from here in Australia. But beyond that, the regulations are incredibly weak. And that's when you start to see a lot of access being bought, and that money has a lot of sway, because if these people are not getting the access that they're paying for, they'll take their money somewhere else. And that's like, we need to see much tougher regulations on that kind of spending. And that also goes a long way to, I think, combating misinformation and combating the narrative that certain politicians are pushing, which undoubtedly is influenced by who has access to their time. People who have access to their time more so than people in their electorate do.
And even like funding to the ABC was cut significantly. And that's, I wonder why that is. And like the government definitely has those connections. So it's a weird cycle again of like, which media are we going to consume? It seems like people have so much of power over the government, but then it's also the other way. And I think it's really which side you choose to look at and which side you choose to act on, instead of saying my choices don't have an impact, because they clearly do.
And also just regarding specifically social media and the idea of misinformation, I think particularly the bushfires, there was an actual genuine issue with fake accounts being created, and there were hundreds of them to promote these stories. It is a very, very real threat to our democracy currently. And I do think actually social media platforms have a responsibility to stop misinformation being spread, because I'm currently doing a report on it for school, actually, and it is shocking, the scale of it, the blatant misinformation and disinformation that is being spread, and information that has been disproven continuously time and time again. And it shouldn't be allowed to be spread on the scale that it is on social media. That in itself is such a massive issue and needs to be quelled somehow.
Mm-hmm. I do have a quick question. Do you think that the state governments are addressing this a bit more effectively as compared to the federal government?
Yes, definitely.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, sorry.
No, you go.
Yeah. State governments, I think, because I mean, you see particularly in New South Wales with, say, Matt Keane, who is our energy minister and is a Liberal, but I think there's much more of that economic focus, which actually has been helpful, because since it makes economic sense, there's been much more of a drive to be transitioning to renewables. I still don't think the states are doing things anywhere near enough, but there is absolutely more progress happening on a state level than federal. And I think because of that, a lot of campaigners are starting to push more on the state level, because we're just seeing there's much more potential for change there.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you, and you girls are such an inspiration. But my main question is, I'm a young 16-year-old from actually a rural community. So when I went to your climate strike a few years ago, when I went back to school, I received lots of hate and threats towards just attending. So for you girls who run it, how do you combat that? How do you combat your peers?
Yeah, for sure. I went to a pretty progressive school in the city, and I still got a lot of crap for it. And it wasn't, but it was a lot of the hate and a lot of the threats that I got were from people online. And they were largely done after, you know, News Corp published a couple of conspiracy articles, you know, attaching me to Labour because Labour's so radical and crazy. Wow. And so it would have been, I think, and I got a lot of threats, quite violent threats from mainly guys online. And I was like, geez, like, you know, got to find something better to do. But, you know, there were, I think, people were a lot more concerned.
Can I ask what they were objecting to? Was it you protesting or the fact that you were a young woman? I mean, what were they taking issue with?
Oh, all of it. Like, me existing, it was too much. There was, and that was without, like, you know, for me, like, as a white woman, it didn't have that element of, like, racialized hate. And so I really got to appreciate, you know, the amount of privilege that I have when it comes to that, because I know a letter was actually sent to her school, I think, you know, near one of the first strikes. There was a woman who called up my school and screamed at one of the women working in the office for about 40 minutes. And I came in, she just looked at me and she was like, you better make a difference because I've just spent 40 minutes on the phone with this woman who hates you. But that's the thing, it's very different to what you would be getting, because for me, I found it easy to deflect other than when someone threatened to come find me and I was like, that's nice. But for you, I can understand that it would be a lot more difficult because it would be directly from people within your community, people that you're connected to, maybe friends with. And so I feel like there is little I can do to make a really helpful difference other than know that you have a community that you can reach out to. And if you want to get involved in the organizational process, but it feels like within your community, that's a very like dangerous thing to do, then, you know, getting in touch with School Strikers online or Stop Adani or whatnot and connecting with those people, I think will make a big difference. It suddenly made me even, like, because I just felt a little isolated within my school, and having that community outside of school really helped a lot. And that's sort of the only suggestion I can make, is that to make connections and to find people who understand the level of danger that we're facing. And I think it makes it a lot easier to handle other people's criticisms, because those are formed by prejudices, and it's largely done out of fear and misunderstanding. And I'm really sorry that you've had to be dealing with that.
Jean and Varsha, how do you deal with the criticism?
First of all, I'm really sorry that you have to deal with any of the criticism. It's not fair, the fact that you care about things that matter. But I think, like, for me, I just remember I was doing Q&A, and the night before, so I hadn't even said a word, and the night before, I was going through Facebook comments, you should never do this, and a bunch of it was about, like, me being a person of color, and I was the only person of color on that panel. And ever since then, and it still does affect me, it's, like, in the back of my mind, it's always, like, oh, Varsha, they just have you as, like, a little tick on their diversity quota, and, like, I don't want to think like that, and, like, I know that perhaps even if it is, I know that I'm going to go on there, I'm going to talk about what I want to say and, like, the main message of climate justice and how important that is. But those kinds of things just do affect you. And no matter how much you tell yourself that you have a community online and everything, it's just hard. But I remember just messaging a friend straight away and being like, yeah, I saw a few comments and they just didn't make me feel great. And having someone say, are you feeling okay during those times, is just so important. And I know that's hard to find, and I can't imagine what it's like in a place where you don't have that physical connection, but I can say that the climate justice community does have an amazing online platform, and I think that's what's really kept me grounded and, like, kind of helped me deflect those comments or just, like, push them out, because I know that we've all got the same objective. A lot of us have gone through the same experiences of dealing with hate, so just know that you're not alone.
I think I've had a fair share of criticism. I think one of the most exciting ones was a letter to my school. It was handwritten, the whole thing. And I remember it ended with something. Oh,
also a shocking amount of spelling errors. They managed to spell... they managed to misspell climate. And then it ended with, P.S., remember, those who can do, those who cannot teach. And yeah, and then I'm trying to think, oh, I remember there was another one of people who used to go to my school and got quite an active Facebook page, and someone had shared a post of me. It's like, oh, so great to see other Fort Street people doing this. And one comment was, of course this was organized by a woman, marches never do anything, which I thought was just, well, what a comment, just everything all a... Yeah, and I think there was more than 200 responses to that. It was fascinating. I went through it. I did dramatic readings with my friends. And it's going on about gyrocentric abuse and how all women are innately abusing all men in their life. It was brilliant. And yeah, I think that for me, because I have that online distance, I think of it as hilarious. I kind of enjoy it to an extent. Like I can go through it, but when it is in real life, that is much more difficult, particularly if it's people at your school. I think a big thing is finding allies within your community, even if it is just one person at school, even if it's just people outside of your school. Being able to have people who you know also believe in this and also care about and also are willing to fight for it is just so useful and affirming, because when you're alone and sort of by yourself in it, it is really difficult to combat that. But just having a single person, even a member of your family, just a single person who is there with you and can say, these people are bullshit. They're just afraid of the fact that you care about something enough to do something about it, is so helpful and is so, so affirming. And yeah, it's difficult, but yeah, definitely online. I feel like I've received a lot of hate, but it's all been funny enough that I've been able to laugh it off.
I think that you three should be running this country, just on a personal level. But it's been such a pleasure talking to you. It's so inspiring. And thank you for your advocacy. And thank you, the audience, for coming this afternoon. So please join me in thanking again Jean, Varsha and Daisy.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.